UTC.
Hello there. Today is Monday, April 17th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, from the U.S. to Jerusalem to Rome, millions celebrate Easter around the world. A defiant North Korea launches a failed missile test.
I think there's a great opportunity for all of us who are really under the threat now of this unpredictable regime, to take action.
Is there such a thing as a travel slump in the U.S.? Also ahead, thousands prepare for the Boston Marathon. It's all on today's International Edition. Christians here in the United States and around the world celebrated Easter on Sunday, the day they believe Jesus rose from the dead. It's the holiest day of the Christian calendar. Church bells rang in Jerusalem as worshippers sang hymns of the resurrection at a sunrise service at the Garden Tomb. Throughout the day, masses of different denominations of both Western and Eastern Christians coexisted in the same holy space of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
Being here where Christ was caused me to strengthen my faith. Really provides a good perspective on who Christ is and what other people believe about Christ, and also it causes me to reflect on truly what I believe about Christ.
It's a holy place, and we are blessed to be here. We are very fortunate to be here.
The Old City also had Jewish pilgrims celebrating the week-long biblical holiday of Passover. In Rome, throngs of the faithful endured heavy security checks to secure a place in the Vatican's flower-filled St. Peter's Square for Pope Francis's celebration of Easter Mass and his delivery of his annual Urbe et Orbe.
Gesù risorto, sostenga gli sforzi di quanti, specialmente in America Latina.
The Pope asked in his prayers for peace in the Middle East, beginning with the Holy Land, as well as in Iraq and Yemen. In Florida, U.S. President Donald Trump attended an Easter church service in Palm Beach, accompanied by First Lady Melania Trump, daughter Tiffany, and son Barron. Melania Trump's parents also were there. The Episcopal Church of Bethesda by the Sea was the site of the president and First Lady's wedding in 2005. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The Turks approve a referendum strengthening presidential powers. Pilgrims flock to Jerusalem to celebrate Easter. 3 years later, Nigerian girls are still missing. And will robots replace human drivers, doctors, and other workers? Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, North Korea conducted a failed missile test on Sunday in defiance of increased U.S. warnings that there would be serious consequences for such provocative actions, including a possible military response. U.S. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster responded Sunday on ABC's This Week.
Well, this latest missile test, it just fits into a pattern of provocative and destabilizing and threatening behavior on the part of the North Korean regime. And I think there's an international consensus now, including the Chinese and the Chinese leadership, that this is a situation that just can't continue.
Meanwhile, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence is in South Korea, part of a 10-day trip to Asia. He was briefed on the failed launch and has been in touch with President Trump. Pence is currently at the Korean Demilitarized Zone. That's a heavily mined strip of land lined with barbed wire running across the Korean Peninsula, where soldiers on both sides are standing in a face-to-face standoff. Well, the vice president's press secretary, Mark Lauder, tells VOA's Elizabeth Hughes developments in North Korea are just one part of President Trump's agenda that Pence will be discussing during this four-nation trip.
The vice president's trip to the Asia-Pacific region is going to be reaffirming President Trump's commitment to strengthen U.S. alliances and partnerships throughout the area. It's going to highlight the president's commitment to building strong economic partnerships and agreements that benefit both the people of the United States and our allies and partners.
Anything specific to South Korea? What is his message for the leaders there?
The U.S.-South Korean alliance is the linchpin of peace and prosperity in the Asia-Pacific region, and it's going to be a very moving visit for the vice president. This will be his first ever trip to South Korea. And what many people may not know is that the vice president's late father earned the Bronze Star during the Korean War. So this will be a very important moment for the U.S. and Korea, but it's also going to be a very important moment personally for the vice president.
Will the issue of tougher economic sanctions on North Korea be discussed as part of the meetings?
Well, the vice president is going to talk about the collaboration that we have between our two countries in confronting the global threat that is posed by North Korea. Obviously, you know, the U.S.-Korean alliance, it's ironclad in its defense, and the global community needs to stand up, and we see it standing up to confront the threat that is placed by North Korea, and that's something that will definitely be a topic in South Korea, but also in the vice president's travels all throughout the Asia-Pacific region.
He'll be going also to Indonesia. What is the U.S. goal for the Indonesian alliance on this trip?
Well, Indonesia is a valued partner with the United States, and it is the largest Muslim-majority democracy in the world. You know, the president and the United States recognizes that Indonesia is a valuable partner in standing firm in the war on terrorism, against violent extremist ideologies, and also a valuable trading partner. So you'll expect to see that the vice president will talk about all of those things and how we can strengthen those partnerships with the people of Indonesia.
It's on a list of 16 countries that we have a bilateral trade deficit, and they're subject to that three-month investigation per President Trump's executive order. He called them cheaters. So how do you intend to bring together that attitude with what you just told me about encouraging trade and good relations?
Well, President Trump has been very clear that he wants free, fair, and balanced trade with all of our partners around the world. And what the president's executive order basically is saying is that here are the countries that we have the largest trade deficits, and it's directing the administration to look into the causes that are behind that deficit, looking for areas where we could possibly address in future trade talks and future bilateral agreements, so we can help balance the tables, make sure that everyone is being treated fair. That's the goal, is to make sure that we're identifying the causes for the deficit. That's what the president is focused on. And then to see if there are any, obviously, potential remedies going forward as we continue our economic talks.
How are you going to measure success for this trip?
Well, I think this trip is a strong sign by President Trump that we place extreme value on our alliances and partnerships in the Asia-Pacific region from an economic standpoint, from a national security standpoint. And so in this trip, you're going to see, obviously, the vice president begin the economic talks with Japan that were agreed to earlier when Prime Minister Abe and President Trump met earlier this year. You will also see the president visit our allies in Australia, where we also have, you know, ongoing partnerships, both from an economic standpoint, but also in terms of combating the global war on terror. So all of these it's about building relationships, maintaining those relationships, and showing the importance that is placed on our Asia-Pacific allies and partners.
That's Mark Lauder, press secretary for Vice President Mike Pence. Well, Democratic voters still hurting from their party's 2016 presidential election loss hope a special election to fill the seat vacated by President Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price will send a message of disapproval to Mr. Trump. VOA's Catherine Gibson traveled to Georgia to see if the president's narrow election win in the traditionally Republican 6th congressional district will be enough to favor Democrats this Tuesday.
Trump's election brought Jen Cox out to the street corner. She's a committed progressive who felt alone among her Republican neighbors until Democrat John Ossoff stepped into the fight for an open congressional seat.
We've got progressive people very worried and angry about Trump's policies. And this is the only race that's on the national stage right now.
Cox says Ossoff will win votes beyond Democrats looking for a win early in the Trump presidency. And that happens door by door, convincing this Trump supporter who says the campaign's efforts have secured her vote.
Yes, I am.
The Georgia 6 hasn't sent a Democrat to Congress since 1979. But the moderate voters here who gave Mitt Romney a 20-point win in 2012 never warmed to Trump's populist message, barely handing him a win.
This is a message that we can send about.
And opening the door for a Democrat like Ossoff.
There are certainly folks in the community here who are concerned that the White House may not be competent, that there's dishonesty, that the president may embarrass us on the world stage. I share those concerns, but this campaign is about a positive vision.
Even with an army of volunteers and an extraordinary $8.3 million fundraising haul, Ossoff faces tough odds.
For John Ossoff to win is for a district to behave unlike what it is at its core of its being. This is a Republican district. This is not a 50-50 district.
Trump has yet to endorse one of the race's 11 Republican candidates. But many, like Bruce Lavelle, head of Trump's diversity council, want to be associated with the early days of his presidency.
We've done a tremendous amount. So I think the six could gain a lot from a person like myself as a congressman that has that great relationship.
Strong contender Bob Gray sees reaching out to passionate Trump voters as a winning path, hitting back on Democrats' claims that voter enthusiasm is on their side.
The fact that the Democratic Party is trying to make this a referendum on Trump is bringing out even more folks.
If none of the candidates emerges as the majority winner on April 18th, the top two will move on to a runoff election in June, giving more time to debate the Trump effect.
It's like a magnetic field. It can both attract and repel.
Democrats hope that will work in their favor. Katherine Gibson, VOA News, Roswell, Georgia.
Well, turning now to social media, we are joined by VOA's Andrew Palcheski. Andrew, thanks so much for being with us. So it sounds like even on this Easter holiday, we haven't been able to avoid some pretty sad news, and people are certainly talking about it.
A sad story, actually, that we're seeing developing: a shooting in the city of Cleveland, Ohio, here in the U.S., where a man was shot and killed, and the shooting was streamed on Facebook Live. The shooter, going in his car, streaming this, goes up to this elderly man and shoots him at point-blank range. And streams this. Now, we've seen this happen before with suicides especially. In fact, Facebook and Twitter and other social media networks that deal with live streaming video have had to deal with the issue of people self-harming and how to address that while they stream that live. And we've actually seen, unfortunately, people be killed on Facebook Live before. That happened, I think it was about a year and a half ago, where a journalist was shot and killed while she was reporting a story by a disgruntled coworker. And he streamed that on Facebook Live. But this is, you know, another instance where we're seeing someone unfortunately die on live stream social media. This gentleman, Steve Stevens, is out in the city of Cleveland, Ohio, and now people are very concerned about his whereabouts and what he might do next. He claims to have killed other people, and who knows, if he's already streamed one murder on Facebook Live, people on social media are speculating how much other damage could he do. And certainly out of this, I think there's going to be a lot of attention paid by Facebook and Twitter and other social media networks to see what they can do to try to prevent these kind of things from going out live.
No doubt. But at the same time, social media also might help bring the person down. So it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds.
Exactly. There are a lot of people asking in the Cleveland, Ohio area for people to stay indoors, and if they see this gentleman, to report it to authorities.
Anything else?
Since it is Easter Monday, we will end on a happier note. For the past, I don't know, about 2 months, there's been a giraffe in New York named April that people have been watching, and it's become an internet phenomenon. She's been expecting a calf. The gestation period for giraffes is about 16 months, so it's been quite a while waiting for her to have this calf. It's very rare for giraffes to have babies in captivity. And finally, on Easter Saturday, she had this baby. But now social media is going to play another part. They're going to actually name the baby. You can go online and vote on different names. So not only did everyone get to see her in labor and have the baby, but now this little new giraffe is going to get its name thanks to social media. And back in like mid-March, people started watching this, and they said, oh, well, the giraffe's name is April. She's going to have it in April. And sure enough, she did.
All right. Well, it's cool. It's cool that there's some happy news to talk about. Thanks so much, Andrew. Follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, as the summer months fast approach, it's usually a very busy time for people from other countries to visit the United States. But experts across the travel industry say there's a sharp drop in foreign tourism to the U.S. They say President Trump's travel bans, currently held up in the courts, along with his immigration policies, are having an unintended consequence of the loss in tourism revenue. Joining me now to talk more about this is Pauline Frommer. She's the editorial director of Frommers.com and Frommers Travel Guidebooks. Thank you so much for being with us. So what exactly can you tell us about what you're observing?
Whether it's fair or not, it's being called the Trump slump. And a lot in the industry have seen bookings either dry up or be canceled from other parts of the world to the United States. New York City has downgraded its estimates for how many visitors it'll get by 300,000. And I can tell you, I'm the author of Frommer's Easy Guide to New York City. For the first time since I've been doing this book, hotel prices are dropping, which is kind of astounding for New York.
Is this since the election?
Yes, this is all since the election. And when there have been studies done abroad, people are pointing to the ban on people from Muslim-majority nations. They're pointing to anecdotal reports of security being more difficult at U.S. airports. They're pointing to widely reported incidents in which people have been held for questioning. And not all of these folks are of Muslim origin. There was a children's book writer, a Christian woman from Australia, who got held at the airport for several hours, and it made the news, and now people in Australia are worried about coming to the United States.
Is it mostly people from Muslim-majority nations that are choosing not to come to the United States, or is this more of just in general people looking for other places to travel coming up here in the summer season?
People from Muslim-majority nations, we're seeing the sharpest drops there in terms of their travel plans. But to be honest, we're seeing drops from everywhere in the world. There's a website called Hopper that said that after the ban on travelers from those seven Muslim nations was implemented, they saw drops in people simply looking for travel to the United States, drops as high as, I think it was 21%. There's an economic consulting firm called Tourism Economics that's done a study, and they expect 6.3 fewer visitors by the end of 2018, which will result in $10.8 billion in spending that will go poof. The travel industry is enormous. people don't understand how many Americans it employs. By some estimates, one out of every 11 Americans has a job somewhat related to travel, either directly at an airport, at a train station, in a hotel, or indirectly at hotels or at restaurants that cater to tourists.
Are you able to say what kind of value of a loss we would see?
People in the travel industry are expecting losses in the billions for incoming travel to the United States, and that's partially because foreign travelers tend to spend much more than domestic travelers. New York City, when it talked about its expected 300,000 loss in visitors for 2017, made the statement that foreign visitors tend to spend $4,000 when they're visiting New York City, whereas domestic visitors tend to spend around $500. So even though 300,000 may not sound like a huge number when you consider the millions who visit New York City, it could be responsible for a lot of jobs lost and money not coming into the city.
It's interesting because the United States has always been portrayed as a place that's a welcoming destination. Do you think that going forward, if the policies of this administration continue, do you think that that reputation of being a welcoming destination and the tourism industry here will continue to be in jeopardy?
I think if we can continue to have our major politicians giving speeches in which they speak about the problems with letting people from elsewhere in the world in as visitors or as immigrants, yes, America could be seen as less welcoming, but it's not just that. People around the world are watching very carefully what's happening in the United States. They're seeing the huge marches. They feel, rightly or wrongly, that there is turmoil here, and people do not want to vacation in places that might be dangerous or simply might have turmoil.
Are people that you talk to, are they worried?
I just got back from New Zealand, and when people heard my accent and realized I was American, most of them came up and said, you know, what is actually happening? We are all worried about what's happening in the United States. I did not meet one person who felt positively right now about coming to the United States. Several told me that they had enjoyed coming in the past, but wouldn't be coming now.
Did they say why?
I think that there's a perception, and I don't know if it's a correct perception, that our airports and getting through customs has become more difficult, and a lot of people don't want that hassle. And there is a perception that their vacation could be destroyed or held up by protests, that there are marches in the streets every day, that there's a lot of turmoil going on here in the United States.
All right. Pauline Frommer, editorial director of Frommers.com and Frommers Travel Guidebooks. Thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it. Well, on April 15th, 2013, the Boston Marathon bombing shook the world. Two bombs that exploded 12 seconds apart near the finish line of the world-famous race killed three people and wounded an estimated 264 others. At least 14 people required amputations. Well, movies such as the feature film Patriot's Day have offered a dramatized account of the events. But John Dunham's recent documentary, Boston, narrated by Boston native Matt Damon, looks beyond the bombings, weaving an uplifting narrative of the race from its inception in 1897 to 2014, the year after the attacks. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
And they're off, some of the fastest men in the world.
The Boston Marathon is officially underway.
By the size of the race, the sheer enthusiasm of the 36,000 racers, and the community spirit during the 2014 Boston Marathon, no one would have guessed that the year before, the event, its participants, and the city itself had been devastated by a terrorist attack. The bombings weighed heavily on the heart of filmmaker John Dunham, a marathon runner himself who had planned years before the attacks to make a documentary about the history of the race.
There were a number of feelings. There was certainly a lot of grieving for what had happened. I walked up and down Boylston Street every day as soon as I arrived here in Boston in January of 2014. And and just thought about it, you know, every day.
His documentary Boston does not focus on the pain and fear in 2013. Instead, it chronicles the Boston Marathon as an event that has fostered charity, unity, and strength since its inception.
A big field of international stars away in a mob scene in the Boston Marathon. 26 miles of tough going ahead of it.
Dunham's film follows the growth of the event through the decades. The race has become more selective, the runners faster. They come from all over the world to compete.
Who want to run like me?
One of them is Kenyan Wilson Chebet.
Long time ago, when I was a child, I used to run to school 3.7 kilometers. Lunchtime, you come back, you go to school after lunch, and then evening you come to home. Yeah, four times in a day.
The documentary shows how the race has also grown into a major fundraising event. It started with Greek Olympic athlete Stylianos Kyriakides, who won the Boston Marathon in 1946.
And used his notoriety as a Boston Marathon champion to raise funds and put together supplies that aided Greece after the war.
With just a few days before this year's race, Boston is getting ready. T.K. Skenderian, Director of Communications at the Boston Athletic Association, is in the middle of the preparations.
In the year that followed, and in the years that have followed, the sense of solidarity and community pride that has emerged from not just those injured, but people locally, people around the world, has been overwhelming. I mean, that sense of civic pride, city pride, pride in the sport of running, has been enormous. Yeah, we were knocked down, but we got back up in a big way.
2 days before the 121st running at the Boston Marathon, John Dunham's documentary is appropriately premiering in its namesake city.
There's so many things that we can't control in life, but getting out and running and setting a goal like running a marathon is something that can be done, and it really does change lives something very, very positive.
Scripture tells us to run with endurance the race that is set before us.
Penelope Poulou, VOA News, Boston.
Thanks for being with us. You've been listening to International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Uganda should take stock of the progress it has made in creating a healthier population. According to the recently released Uganda Demographic Health Survey, there are some clear and positive trends. More women delivering babies in health facilities, substantial reductions in infant and under 5 mortality rates, and an increased percentage of households with at least one insecticide-treated bed net to combat malaria. But while these statistics are encouraging, they mask a troublesome reality. The health of most Ugandans remains poor, with children especially at risk. There are many reasons to explain this situation, but most boil down to the fact that the country's healthcare system is under-resourced, poorly managed, and unable to meet the demands of a growing population. The evidence is clear. In developing countries, a government's investment in the health and well-being of its citizens is key to generating prosperity and progress. President Museveni pledged in the 2001 Abuja Declaration and reaffirmed in 2013 to dedicate 15% of the national budget to health. Today, that number stands at just 7%. Moreover, the government of Uganda's proposed budget for the next fiscal year recommends nearly a one-third cut for the Ministry of Health, plus reductions in other health investments. More must be done to meet the healthcare needs of Uganda's citizens, especially its youngest and most vulnerable. There are still at least 2.4 million Ugandan children under 5 who are chronically malnourished. Only 2/3 of people living with HIV are receiving life-saving antiretroviral therapy, and there are 8.5 million cases of malaria annually. The proposed reductions to the country's health budget will put these lives in greater jeopardy. The United States has done its part to help build a healthier Uganda. Last year alone, we invested nearly $500 million, more than 1 trillion Ugandan shillings, in the country's health sector to control the HIV/AIDS epidemic, combat tuberculosis, improve maternal and child health, and control malaria. This work is saving lives and improving the health of millions of Ugandans, and we are proud to contribute to such efforts. The U.S. government calls upon the government of Uganda to increase investment in the health of its people so Uganda can reach its full economic potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.